Every month we get to meet people whose individual stories are intertwined with the story of the region. Stories of Southern Oregon are compiled by Maureen Flanagan Battistella for the Southern Oregon Digital Archive, which we call SODA, at the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University. This month, Maureen is back with Paul Tipton, who served in the Navy during the Vietnam War and went looking for a new place to live. And boy, did he find it in the Applegate Valley, which has been his home in the decades since. He's here now to share a portion of his story. Paul Tipton, Maureen Battistella, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Good morning. Thanks.
So tell us, you were in the Seabees, the construction battalion. It was a choice, more or less, though, to keep from getting into the Vietnam War in a way you didn't want, I gather.
Well, I knew I was going to be drafted and thought I'd join the Navy and avoid Vietnam. But with construction skills that I had, I was pretty immediately placed in the Seabees.
Mm-hmm. And how much time did you spend in Vietnam itself?
Between 1968 and 69, I was there for 7 months, and then again in 1970-71, I was there for another 6 months. In between, we were stationed in Okinawa as a ready battalion to go to Vietnam if necessary.
And in the construction battalions, I mean, are you generally building things that allow the acts of war to take place?
Both that and rebuilding things that had been blown up and would be blown up again in the future, likely. But repairing railroad bridges, repairing and installing airfield matting for helicopters and planes to land on in remote sand-filled sites and that sort of thing.
Is construction? I mean, if you've built a home or at least put up a wall or something, does it sort of all make sense after a while?
Well, there were lots of a lot of variety of the work that we did. I was a steel worker, and so a lot of the work that I did was actually building buildings or bridges or metal construction, not wooden construction for the most part.
Mm-hmm. So you came from Pennsylvania before you went off into the Navy, and then but was that not an option as a place to go back to once you got out of the Navy?
I grew up in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and didn't feel like my community accepted me very well after I returned from Vietnam, and my hair was growing long and my beard had grown out, and so I was a hippie instead of a veteran, pretty much. And so I decided to visit a friend of mine who I'd been in the service with that was living in Ashland, and came here in 1972 and went to school, eventually graduated here from Southern Oregon College at that time, or Southern Oregon State College, I think it was at the time I actually graduated.
Go Raiders.
Yeah.
Right, right. Wow, SOSC does seem like a long time ago. But I mean, the region had a hold on you, it sounds like, from pretty early on.
I've always enjoyed being out in nature, and of course, there's a lot less density of people per acre in Oregon than there is in Pennsylvania. It really seemed to me like there were too many people too close together back on the East Coast at the time I came back, and I was looking for a little bit more openness in my life. So after going my first term, two terms to Southern Oregon College, I ended up being offered a work-study job with U.S. Forest Service and Star Ranger Station in the Applegate area. And I continued working for them as a seasonal employee, going to school half a year and working for them half a year.
Was that the first time you'd been out in the Applegate, Paul?
I arrived in Southern Oregon in July of 72, and within a couple of days I had driven up into the Applegate area and pretty much decided already that that was my home.
This was it. This is my place, huh?
And then while working for the Forest Service around 1975, I met my wife, who was working there as well, and we've been together for 43 years or so now.
Is she a native Oregonian?
She is. She grew up west of Portland and on a family farm there, and she'd just graduated from a forestry program at OSU.
Janice is on a century farm, a family farm.
Yes, it was a century farm.
That's a big deal.
Yes.
So you mentioned working for the Forest Service. Was that your major source of income? I mean, what became your livelihood once you were out of Southern Oregon State College?
Well, I continued going to Southern Oregon College from 1973 until 1984. So
the 10-year plan.
I was an intermittent student. In that time period, I had met and married and started to have, we had children. And so I worked a lot of different jobs. I worked farming jobs and eventually worked in the early vineyard industry. I worked for Valley View Vineyard, starting out picking grapes and ended up pretty much being the vineyard manager by 1984 or so. So I worked there for 7 years doing that kind of work, and then eventually transitioned into construction again, which I had a pretty solid base of abilities in.
Boy, no kidding. That must have done you in good stead. I mean, you could easily just move back into construction at any time.
Well, and construction at that time was far more lucrative than farm work. I really enjoy working outside in all respects, but I need to get paid for what I'm doing enough to.
Right. Paul Tipton's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. This month's Stories of Southern Oregon. He's here with Maureen Flanagan Battistella, the curator of the Stories of Southern Oregon collection. Maybe you've heard of Paul before. Maybe you've run into him before. If you want to join the conversation, join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The Valley View Vineyard part is really interesting because, so you were involved in the wine industry before it was particularly big in this part of Oregon.
Yes, everything was a pretty nascent industry at that point. And actually, I started working for Valley View Vineyard just shortly after the man who planted the vineyard, Frank Wisnowski, died in an accident up at a diving accident at Lost Creek Lake. And his wife and family were needing people to help to run the family operation there, and it's still a family-run operation. And so I started working for them, like I said, picking grapes, and ended up enjoying the work and doing a lot of the farming of the grapes, not the winemaking particularly, but the growing of the grapes.
Had John Guerrero come by that time?
John Guerrero just arrived there right before I left Valley View Vineyard. Okay. Yeah, he had been there for about a year and a half or something like that. Yeah. He was fresh out of college at that point, but is still there.
Good
there?
Winemaker.
Yes,
I think
definitely.
He's the
they make great wines,
and in the state.
They're great folks, the Wisnowski family.
So, were you? I mean, did you basically get involved only as far as where the grapes came out of the field, and then it was not your area? I mean, were you involved in the winemaking part of it at all?
Primarily, just the growing of the grapes and the tasting of the wine.
Uh-huh.
I had to be involved with that.
Sure. Did you get a few bottles to take home, that sort of thing?
I did, actually.
I'd like to get back to that idea of the forest. It seems to be a kind of repeated idea for you, a source of comfort. Were there other people in the same situation that you were that found solace in the forest?
Well, I don't know. That's...
I mean, was it just working in the forest, or was it getting a little more spiritual too?
It was a return to the land generally, I guess. I'd been raised in a small community and not a farming or hunting family at all, but I really enjoyed being outside and doing things related to that. So I don't know. I just had a particular personal penchant for being out in the woods and learning all the plants and animals and relating to that. There were other people, certainly other veterans who were in the Forest Service at that point, who were perhaps seeking that same thing, or maybe that's just some of them lived around here as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned working for the Forest Service out of the Star Ranger Station originally. Obviously, there's Forest Service land all around there. What was the Rogue River National Forest, now the Rogue River Siskiyou. And that's an area that there's always been, or it seems like there's always been, at least since about the time you got there. And I'm not saying that you were directly involved, but some opposition to the forestry techniques being used on the land. But you did get involved with that, didn't you?
I did, actually. Yes, I worked for the Forest Service for... through about 1976 as a seasonal employee, and through that time I was asked to be involved in their herbicide spray program, which involved helicopters spraying basically the same chemicals that were used in Agent Orange in Vietnam were being sprayed on the forests of Southern Oregon. I declined for the most part to be involved in that directly and worked in water monitoring of those herbicide sites, but found that I was the first person to ever be involved in trying to monitor the water coming out of those sites. There wasn't any program at all for that at that time. After leaving the service, I became involved with a group and started a group called Applegate Citizens Opposed to Toxic Sprays when a couple of local people found out that there was going to be helicopter spraying on BLM land within about 1,000 feet of the Applegate school. We protested that, and...
Is that when you got involved with Chris?
Yes, that's when I met Chris Pratt, and Chris Pratt and I were co-chairs of Applegate Citizens Opposed to Toxic Sprays, which eventually morphed into part of the Headwaters organization, which today has morphed into what is GEOS.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was involved in some of that early stuff.
Were you involved with the Applegate partnership, too, in the early 90s, early to mid-90s?
I am, but only kind of on the periphery as far as that aspect of it. The Applegate partnership's been involved in a number of things, and I'm currently involved in a group called A Greater Applegate, which spun off from the Greater Applegate Community Development Corporation, which was formed to manage Cantrell Buckley Park about 22 years ago when the county ran out of funding for county parks. They were going to close the park, and so the Applegate partnership started some of that happening as far as creating a group that came together to manage the park. And now Jackson County has just come back to us recently and asked to take over the management of the park, and we'll still be involved in a lot of projects having to do with enhancements to the park.
It's a very pretty park right along the Applegate River for
it
the
is.
Folks
it's
who
one
don't
of the,
know it. Yeah.
It's one of the only real accesses for the public to the Applegate River along the whole stretch of it, as far as having picnic grounds and places to fish and camp and stuff.
Yeah, I'm surprised time and again over 30-plus years of living in Southern Oregon how well the Applegate community tends to come together on things.
Yeah.
There is no incorporated city out there. Rouche is not incorporated. The hamlet of Applegate is not incorporated. There's nothing out there that's an actual city, and yet you manage to function as a community where things get done.
They're all joiners.
Yeah, people in are very community oriented as far as helping their neighbors out. I've helped a lot of people raise houses and barns, and people have helped me build my buildings. There's a lot of cooperative spirit there. This group that I'm involved with, we actually see that as somewhat of a concern that there isn't any incorporation in the valley. And one of the things we've just instigated is a valley-wide website that is interactive, and people can log on to see what's going on, a calendar of events and
is that
directories.
Applegate?
That's applegateconnect.org.
Yeah.
And that's just come online in the last 4 or 5 months, and check it out. It's a very good website. If you're doing anything in the Applegate or looking for activities to do in the Applegate, it's a very good resource. Lots of information on there.
Is there a younger generation that is getting involved in things in the Applegate Valley now? I mean, we had Chris Bratton here a few months ago talking about some of the same things we're talking to you about, but you guys have been here since the 70s, and I just wonder if people who've been, if your children and maybe even your grandchildren's generation are starting to get active out there too, or are active already.
Well, it's interesting. I think a lot of the children of from my generation that my generation generated have moved on. My kids all went off to other places because they could make more money in other places and follow their career choices. They all love the area and would return if they felt they could support themselves here. On the other hand, there's been an influx of a lot of young farmers to the area that has really brought quite a change and a positive change in small farming and bringing agriculture back to the valley that's been lost over the years. There used to be turkey ranching and lots of different farming activities in the Applegate Valley that have passed, and it looks to me like small farming and young families are primarily the people that are involved with that is a major thing, and I strongly support the small farmers in the Applegate Valley. It's a real good deal and good food.
Is the place still largely undiscovered? I mean, has it gotten to a place of like people with money moving in and starting to build rural residences? I know there's obviously some caps on that, since it's good land.
Yes, and all that's changing fairly rapidly, and we don't really know the outcomes yet, I guess, in regards to the cannabis industry moving into the area, that's been a real major thing in the last couple of years in terms of especially the larger commercial operations that have come in. And there's also been quite an increase in the vineyard industry of large commercial operations going in rather than smaller mom-and-pop type things. And the smaller mom-and-pop cannabis places are kind of going out of business too. I think a lot of it's going to go to larger commercial stuff. So we'll see how that changes.
We talked about that a little bit too with respect to the Grange. The Grange kind of saw an influx of new younger people that couldn't really spare the time to contribute to the larger
community. A lot of people that there's the idea of the community spirit, but whether people really have the ability to do that, some of the younger people particularly, just because they're young families and have their own small businesses and stuff. And I can relate. I when I was younger, I didn't have time to volunteer in the community very much. And since I've retired, I've become almost over-involved as far as that part of it. It's pretty easy to get slammed.
There are an awful lot of parties out there in the Applegate. Last weekend was McKee Bridge. The weekend before that was Buncombe. Down in July, we've got Cantrell Buckley. It seems like every weekend you talked about the Pie Social for 100 people.
Yes.
Well, there's parties everywhere out there.
Well, I don't know whether they're parties, but they're gatherings, yes. And that's an important thing to me, to try to see that community comes together and has a place and a facility for being able to do that. And so I'm involved with a number of different organizations in the Applegate Valley that work toward community things.
Paul Tipton's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and this month's Stories of Southern Oregon, and curator Maureen Flanagan Battistella, back in the studio with us to keep us up to date on the people she's met who are now being included in the Southern Oregon Digital Archive. McKee Bridge, I almost forgot to ask about that. You've been involved with that pretty much since you got to the Valley, haven't you? The restoration of it and the upkeep?
Well, not involved with the group. McKee Bridge Historical Society, which I'm currently president of, was established in 1999. A number of other groups, community groups, had come together over the years in different fashions to keep the bridge restored. My covered bridge thing is that I grew up fishing off of a covered bridge outside of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, just about a mile away from Eisenhower's farm. And so I like covered bridges. I've spent some time driving around the states looking at old covered bridges, and around this state actually too. And I've been involved with the McKee Bridge Group for about 10 or 11 years now, I guess, and I've been president this past year. And we were involved in a major restoration of the bridge, which was built in 1917, and we just celebrated the centennial of having it finally opened up just about a year or so before the centennial. And the bridge had been closed even to pedestrian traffic for several years and needed some upgrades of the timbers underneath it.
But now you just had a wedding out there, didn't you? So it's
It's available for weddings and lots of whatever activities people want to have out there. So we had a Pie Social recently, like I said to Maureen earlier, that I believe we had over 100 people out on the bridge. And it was within the weight limit, too.
That's good. That's a point. I haven't asked you about your poetry. You got your degree at Southern Oregon State College, or Southern Oregon College, involved working with Lawson and Nada. Is that right?
I did. I met Lawson back in the early 70s, whenever I first started going to school here, and took a number of classes with him relating to poetry, and finished up some of my final work just doing one-on-one study with both he and another professor whose name will come to me later. In any case, Lawson's a friend and mentor, and just recently in the last couple of years he came out to the Applegate Valley and helped us establish a poetry group out there. And I haven't seen him in a bit, but he was very influential to me as far as a person, and I always strongly related to his writing about being interned in the Japanese prisoner of war camps at Tule Lake and all of that. And yet he was very accepting of me as a veteran and somebody was that was sort of on the other side of that, I suppose. Mm.
Yeah, Lawson Annotta, I should point out to the folks listening, it was the former poet laureate of Oregon, and I had him in here a few years ago, and he started asking me questions. He's just that kind of guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's right on top of it, for sure. Yeah,
So have you written a lot of poetry? Have you published any poetry?
I've published a few things over the years. I started out publishing a couple of things with publications that came out of Southern Oregon College, then Southern Oregon State College. There used to be some annual poetry things that came out. And then I've also been published in an anthology of Vietnam poets that came out, I believe, in the early 1980s, and a few other things. I don't submit a whole lot, and I haven't written a whole lot in recent times.
Is there some body of work you're holding on to, trying to get to publication at some point?
I have part of the work that I did while going to college was to try and create a number of short stories, vignettes, character sketches and that I put together, but they haven't ever formed a cohesive whole as far as mostly this is relating to my experiences in Vietnam.
Is there any place people can find your work online, your poetry or any of the other material?
Yes, the Oregon Poetic Voices, is that what it is?
Okay, we'll see if we can find it. We'll put a link to that on our website at jeffexchange.org. Paul Tipton, this month's guest in our Stories of Southern Oregon segment, where Maureen Flanagan Battistella is the curator and brought him into the studio. Good to have you both here. Paul, pleasure to meet you.
Thanks for having me.